Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. We are back today with Vietnam Origins with my co-host, John Phan. How are you?
How's it going, Kenneth? I'm doing good. Good to see you again.
It's good. It's crazy to see the comments in the comment section on YouTube. It is, it's fun. And I think that it feels like a very sticky sub-series. So today we are going to go into the AMA, the comment section, and we're going to explore what people left in regards to the last episode that we did together.
Yeah, exactly. So excited to do this. The engagement has been great. It's been awesome to see that. And we have a lot, you know, I feel like so many of those questions could be their own episode.
Yeah.
So let me apologize in advance because we won't, you know, we don't have time to get into all of the different weeds that people are talking about, but we'll get into as much as we can today.
Some of them are kind of funny. When you know that, like, just, it's like, okay, all right, Professor John misspoke, right? Like, I think one of the comments was like, bro straight up said garlic was German or something, right?
Actually, that is on my list because that one, that dude, props to you. He is 100% right. So Gaulish is a Celtic language. In my defense, I was thinking Frankish. So Frankish is a Germanic language. The history of France is super complicated. The Gauls were Celtic people originally inhabited there, and then they're conquered by the Franks who are Germanic. So actually, that one I don't mind because he's right about that. We don't want to spread misinformation. Gaulish is Celtic. But then there's like, don't ever say 100% positive. I'm like, dude, I am 100% positive. It is okay to say 100% positive. But bless your heart, I appreciate the engagement.
Okay. And this is what we're going to be spending this hour on. We're going to really talk about this idea of what is within the sort of the measurement, the metrics of what is the, there's a word for it, like in car automotive, where you have, you know, what's tolerance levels, right?
Mm.
You know, because I think some of these things are, could be debatable, yeah. Maybe not, but we'll get into that because I want to hear your thoughts on it. But before we go, just want to let everybody know, you know, thank you for the donations and the contributions.
Ah.
We welcome them. We've had some pretty big donations that, you know, that we are pleasantly surprised. And we thank, who is the sender who sent the big one, John?
Oh, Eileen, I think her name is. Her name. God bless you. Yeah.
Eileen, thank you so much. And we'll continue to do these episodes with or without donations. We love what we do, but we are also here to ask for donations as well.
Yeah, thank you so much. I got a haircut. I don't know if you're only listening, you can't see, but I got a haircut, and thank you for your support for that haircut. So please do say what you can.
All right, so we have a few things that we're going to go into. We'll start with the fact-checking and correcting some of the mistakes that were made on the last episode.
Yeah, actually, the main one I wanted to correct was Gaulish because it was bad. I mean, it wasn't bad. It was just a slip of the tongue because I was thinking of Frankish, but it's very right to call that out. So Gaulish is Celtic, Frankish is Germanic. I just want to make that clear. I also just want to mention because, you know, we record these episodes in a particular order. So sometimes the fact check is a little disconnected from maybe the last thing you saw. So just keep that in mind when you listen to the beginnings of our episodes and maybe go back to those episodes to draw the line between, you know.
And with these, we're trying to correlate them to the last one, but sometimes I guess we'll have to dip into like earlier ones if that happens.
Yeah, sometimes. And also keep it coming. Exactly. Yeah. Keep it coming. Cause you know, we do these live, they're casual, they're conversation. So I mean, we misspeak. I misspeak all the time. So it's actually a great service to everyone who's listening and to me and Kenneth to, if you see a factual thing that's incorrect, please do call it out. That is not the same thing as ignoring the content of the podcast and then just spewing your opinions, which you're welcome to do as well. God bless you. But saying thank you for are those people who are like, oh, I don't think he meant that, or you know, that fact is maybe not right. You know, keep that coming. That's great.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, just to call it out, sometimes people are just reading the thumbnail and they're making assumptions based on the thumbnail. I'm like, take some time to like listen to the thing or read the article before you make a comment, you know?
So. Yeah, I know. I mean, it's human nature, but it's like, you know, it's like for my students, I'm like, read the damn syllabus, read the syllabus. So the answer is there. So a lot of the times, people are raising issues because they're reacting to the thumbnail as can be, as you say, and all they need to do is listen to the actual episode because we talk exactly about that topic. And I'll shout out again to our earlier episodes. I think a lot of the things that are coming up are still things that we've actually talked about at length, like the genealogical affiliation of Vietnamese, like the difference between genetics and linguistic history, like the emotional investment in language and nationalism. And all those things are things we talked about in our pilot episode and in our first couple of episodes. So please do go back and give those a listen because your questions are addressed there a lot of the times.
Great. So were there any other mistakes that you wanted to correct, John?
There might have been, honestly, but the main one was Gaulish. It kept me up at night. I was like, damn it. Gaulish is Celtic. But that dude's right.
Simple, that's a simple misspeaking, right? Like sometimes we'll say American or what we meant, it was French. I think it's a simple mistake. So, you know.
Yeah, which is why I'm grateful for those people who called it out because, you know, it is a simple thing, but we don't want to misinform. So, yeah, I think that was the main one.
And I think some people sort of like when I go through the comments, I think people are assuming, and this is clearly when people are not listening to the episode, that they're assuming that we are saying Vietnamese came from Sinitic roots. And I think that's not the argument that you are saying. But anyway, it goes back to that, like listening before the comments happen.
Yeah, exactly. And check out our previous episodes because I can see that, you know, you didn't listen to the other episodes about like Vietnamese being Austroasiatic, you know, for example, which we talked about so much in a previous episode. You come into this episode and maybe it's a little confusing. So, you know, have a listen to those earlier ones. Oh, I did want to mention, this is not really a fact check, but it is a thing I wanted to shout out from an earlier episode. We did our earlier episode about the linguistic affiliations. We talked a lot. We had a great question about Chinese borrowed words and, you know, certain words. Like I think, Kenneth, you mentioned khai in that episode,
right?
Which means cute in a particular way. And I talked a lot about these Chinese words that are manufactured in Japan in the early 20th century and then spread to Vietnam and Korea and China as well. Those Sinitic neologisms, we call them. But I wanted to shout out because we had a couple people in the comments that we didn't get to in the AMA for that episode, but they noted that Vietnam also engaged in that process where they took, Vietnamese intellectuals took Han Viet, Sinitic words and created their own neologisms. And that was a really good an important point that those people made. So it wasn't just Japanese intellectuals doing this. Vietnamese intellectuals did it as well. Vietnamese continue to do that actually with our language to produce new words based on Sinitic elements, even in the modern day. And of course, that's also true in China and Korea as well. So great, great, great comment from those people.
John, can you explain what Sinitic neologism is?
Yeah, sorry. Again, it's like a throwback from an earlier episode. I use the word Sinitic all the time to refer to things that are, you might just call Chinese, because as we've talked about at length, because of the specter of modern nationalism, I don't want to confuse people. I don't want people to get confused between what we think of as Chinese or China today and all the different elements of culture or language that can be traced back to past Chinese empires or past Chinese language. So I use the word Sinitic in that sensibility. And in this case, I'm talking about Chinese language. So ancient Chinese linguistic elements, which I will call Sinitic. And then the word neologism means a new word, a word that is neologos, a new word that's created anew. So these are words that are created from Chinese elements, but they didn't exist in the ancient past. They're newly created. So a good example of that in a non-Asian context is like the word tachyon. I don't know if you're a sci-fi fan. Tachyon is a kind of particle, and it uses a Greek word, a Greek base, but it obviously no one in ancient Greece used the word tachyon. So that's the kind of thing we do in East Asia. We take ancient Sinitic elements and we create new words from them.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply, in-app only.
You know, that's, I want to apologize to the audience. If anybody thinks that I don't know what these things mean, I don't mean to waste time, and I don't mean to, but my job here is to make sure that anybody who doesn't understand these things has a little way, because, you know, obviously not every audience member gets to speak up, but I've learned, because other people have said that sometimes this feels like inside baseball. And I don't want to feel that way. I want it to feel accessible to everyone. So my job is in the seat of a student is to ask the professors that we have on these questions, even though they might seem very basic, but it gives us a ground for understanding what's going on. Just want to put that out there.
Yes. Thanks, Kenneth. And please do. I get carried away. You know that. So you gotta restrain me.
No, it's okay. Awesome. So did we need to go into Sinitic neologism anymore?
No, I think that's good for that one. You know, there may be more questions, but we can go on from there to the next questions.
Okay. Yeah. At the difference of cosmopolitans and vernaculars and the plural on both of those.
Yeah, so we got a bunch of different questions about cosmopolitan vernacular, because this is a big concept. We talked about in that episode. We'll actually talk about it again in the next episode on Junome. Just to recap quickly, cosmopolitan languages are languages that traverse territories, traverse boundaries. So they're usually great transnational, you could say, in the modern sense, state languages that have become powerful across different communities. So English is a cosmopolitan language today. Hindi was and is a cosmopolitan language of South Asia. Latin was a cosmopolitan language in medieval Europe.
Mandarin.
Mandarin is a cosmopolitan language today, exactly. And of course, in pre-modern East Asia, literary Sinitic or literary Chinese, Ban Ngôn, as we call it, was a great cosmopolitan language across all of East and lots of Southeast Asia as well. So the questions we, and then the vernaculars are the local regional languages that originally are only spoken, but then maybe get to start being written down in different societies. So spoken Vietnamese was a vernacular language alongside literary Chinese for a long time. So we got a lot of questions about modern cosmopolitans and vernaculars, because things get complicated. It's not as simple as Latin and then Latin being written alongside Spanish, French, Italian, etc. But in the modern world, we have multiple cosmopolitans and multiple vernaculars. We always had multiple vernaculars because that's the local regional language, right? But I just wanted to say a quick word about how you could think about this. So you can see in many places where there, a place even like China, where there are not only multiple vernacular languages, but multiple prestige languages that people are using to engage with different cosmopolitan systems, different global systems, or different multi-regional systems. So the vernacular part is pretty easy, right? So in a place like China, you have not only your vernacular dialect or Chinese language, you might speak Minanhua, you might speak a Fujianese language, or you might speak Cantonese, or you might speak Shanghainese, but maybe you don't even speak a Chinese language, maybe you speak Zhuang, which is a Kradai language, or you speak a Hmong language or a Mian language. It could be a genealogically unrelated language that you speak as a member of that community. So you, say, for example, you're a Zhuang person, but you live in Guangzhou City. So maybe you speak your Kradai language, Zhuang, because you grew up speaking that. That's one vernacular language. But you also speak Cantonese because that was a kind of the regional language of that area in Guangdong. That's another kind of vernacular language, but it's also a kind of mini cosmopolitan language, right? Because in that area, maybe people from different ethnic communities all speak Cantonese. But then now in the modern world, you speak Mandarin as well, because Mandarin is the national language of the PRC. And to go to school, to get a job, you have to speak Mandarin. So that's a third, that's a second cosmopolitan language and a third language you might speak. And then to make things even more complicated, maybe you also learn to read, write, and speak a little bit of English, because that's a global cosmopolitan language, yet another cosmopolitan language. So you speak English and Mandarin as two cosmopolitan languages, and Cantonese as a kind of mini cosmopolitan language. And then you also speak Zhuang, you speak your Kradai language, maybe with your friends and family back from your home village as your vernacular language. So that's just one way to think about how complicated cosmopolitans and vernaculars can be today. And of course, you can apply that to Vietnam, where we have 54 ethnic minorities, right? So maybe you speak Muong because you're a Muong person living in Hòa Bình, but you also speak Tai, a form of Tai, because maybe you're in close contact with Tai peoples in that area, two vernacular languages. But then you also speak Vietnamese, you speak Tiếng Việt, because that is the mini cosmopolitan, that's the national language of Vietnam. And then you also speak English because it's the global cosmopolitan language. So this is a very flexible concept that you can play around with and apply to different sort of social systems. And the last thing I'll say is that when you engage in different cosmopolitan languages, it is maybe because they represent slightly different social or cultural systems. So you read and write and speak Mandarin, going back to the Chinese example, because you want to be able to be educated in China and get a good job in the People's Republic of China. But you also speak a little English because maybe you love the Marvel Cinematic Universe and you want to be a part of that sort of global community, you know? Same thing, maybe you also speak Korean because you love K-pop. So it gives you access to these different big worlds. And that's part of the appeal of learning these different sort of multi-regional cosmopolitan languages. You know, okay, so those were great questions. Yeah.
So when I think about America in general, and I think about most Americans only speak one language, which is English. And I think all over Europe, they're speaking multiple languages. You run into Chinese people, merchants of the previous generation, they speak four or five different languages too. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of them that speak Thai, Cambodian, Mandarin, Cantonese, Vietnamese. You see a lot of these in the 626 area in where I live in LA. Mm. They speak multiple languages. When I think about the complexities of America and I think about the driver of culture in America and the sophistication, it's kind of heartbreaking when I think about the political kind of landscape. And I just want to make a commentary as I'm hearing you break down all these things. You hang out in the big cities in America and in Vietnam or Korea, and there's all of this energy going on with like French people, Italian people, Korean people, Vietnamese people. There's people from all over. But then you think about America as like the whole chunk of it, and most of them only speak American English. And it's scary to think that when the world lumps us all together, it could be a very general thing. They only speak one language. And when you think about like Vietnam in the middle of nowhere, it's only what kind of one language as well. So the spread of the internet is what I wanted to comment on, is this ability to kind of understand that there's so much nuance happening all over in between these big places like America. There's people who only speak English and only have a very limited understanding of politics, of culture. And they can only see a very small sliver of the world because of the limited capacity of language.
Yeah, Completely. I mean, I think one point that I think you're making is that I really appreciate is that language does open the door. It opens the door to experiencing a particular culture or set of cultures that is irreplaceable. You know, you can learn all these things about a culture and still that culture will be barred from you without learning the language. The language will open that door in a way nothing else does. I think that's really true. You know, it's really super true. And then the other thing I would say is that, you know, this comment about America and about Americans speaking only English, it'd be interesting to look at the actual statistics, because I think certainly a lot of Americans do speak more than one language. Maybe not, you know, like white America, you know, but a lot of America, we are multilingual. But the thing that you're observing is actually anthropologically very well documented. And that is that the greater your position of power or prestige, the less likely you are to speak multiple languages. Now, I can hear all the Europeans being like, wait a second, what about Europe? I hear you, you're right. But generally speaking, the more powerful your culture and your language is, the less likely you are to need to speak more than one language.
Never thought of it that way.
Yeah, so you go to ethnic minorities in Vietnam and it's very clear. Like if you are, you know, if you're you know, a Hmong person in northwestern Vietnam, you probably speak both at minimally Hmong and Vietnamese. But if you're a Kinh person from Hanoi, what are the chances you actually speak Hmong, right? And you might be like, well, I'm a Kinh person in Hanoi. I also speak English. But that Hmong person, if she has a chance and she moves to a place where she can learn it, she almost certainly also speaks English, right? So it stacks in that way. The more restricted the reach of your personal languages, your vernacular languages, the more likely you are going to be required to learn more languages in order to negotiate the world, unless you're staying in your vernacular space, in your village, you know? So that's very normal. And if you amplify that out to the global stage, English is simple. It's just spoken everywhere. You can get around so easily with English in the world, and certainly within the US, that the social pressure, the socio-political pressure to learn other languages is very low. Now, a place like Europe is a little bit of a counterpoint to that, because Europeans are typically multilingual, you know, but that is also expressive of the power dynamic within Europe, which is more unilateral, or that's not the multilateral rather, you know, and therefore easier, you know, easy, you know, there's a kind of demand for learning multiple languages that does not exist in a place like the US. So there is room for both of those realities to coexist. But the basic anthropological principle is to link multilingualism with power, or rather the opposite of you know what I mean. Yeah.
And that brings us to the next topic, which is there was a comment in the comment section that said something to the effect of Chinese people don't set out to conquer, right? The idea of like pushing for the boundaries of empires is not what the Chinese do. And Chinese empires and modern Chinese nationalism, we need to comment on that, because I think that, again, it's one of those things where I think that they didn't listen to what we were saying, but they just probably read the title and the thumbnail.
Yeah, actually, I was very glad to see this thread in the comments, because it reveals something that's very important for, I think, hopefully we have a few regular listeners. And that is that I consistently come down hard on Vietnamese nationalism. Not that I think nationalism is necessarily a bad thing, but I think that we as Vietnamese people have a responsibility to reflect on the role of nationalism in our own thinking and the way we think about our own culture, you know? And so I'm always, of course, obviously focusing on Vietnamese nationalism, on, for example, as we talked about last episode, how we think about the Thời Bắc Thuộc, you know, like the period of Chinese domination, and how we might be biased about that. But what I'm happy to see is that in the comments from that last episode, we not only saw Vietnamese nationalism on display, but we saw Chinese nationalism on display. And that is a good reminder that when I talk about this phenomenon of how nationalist ideation or nationalist ideas, you know, can cloud our own thinking. I'm not just talking about Vietnam. Everyone in the world virtually does this. And people, Chinese nationals in the modern world certainly engage with this as well. There is a nationalist ideology of Chinese history that is told and is taught, just like there is a nationalist ideology of Vietnamese history and a nationalist ideology of American history and so on and so forth. It just happens to be that this podcast is called The Vietnamese, and our series is called Viet Origins, not Chinese Origins. So we don't spend as much time on it. But since this came up, hooray, we can talk about it a little bit now. And one of the cornerstones of modern Chinese nationalist ideology is this idea that China, quote unquote, never conquered anybody. That, you know, somehow the Chinese waltzed through history and people just, you know, flocked to the Chinese like you know, as if to a magnet or like moths to a flame. You know, we never conquered anybody. You hear that over and over and over again. But first of all, this is where the intersection of China and Vietnam is very useful, because the history of Vietnam, the history of that first 1,000 years, is the perfect counterexample to that claim. The Red River Plain was absolutely conquered. It was conquered by force. The south, all of the south of China was conquered by force. You know, the cradle of Sinitic civilization is the Yellow River. And look at the map of the PRC today. That did not happen on a voluntary basis, okay? You know, someone asked, well, what did ever the Chinese extract from other nations or from Vietnam, et cetera? So I just want to read from my book. I'm not the only one to translate this passage. This is a passage from, This is a passage from one of the official histories of China called the San Guo Zhi, Tam Quốc Chí, if you know Vietnamese, the record of the three kingdoms. This is the record of the three kingdoms, by the way, not the romance of the three kingdoms. The romance of the three kingdoms is a novel based on this time, but this is the actual official record. And in this record, there is a description by a man of the area of Zhao Ti, as we call it, Zhao Zhi, whether he's Chinese or Vietnamese, he's neither. If you've been listening to our previous episodes, but he writes, he's describing the relationship between officials in the area, imperial Han officials in the area, not technically Han, but Han in the sort of political sense, not the dynasty, and the people of the region. And he says, the district offices, meaning the imperial offices, bridle them, meaning the local people, by show of force, and the taxes on fields and households are planned and administered for their customized collection. This is extraction, right? Treasures are sent up to them of distant jewels. This is the specific answer to what was extracted. Treasures are sent up to them of distant jewels, famous gems, fragrant medicines, elephant tusks, rhinoceros horns, tortoise shell, corals, glass, parrots, jadeite, peacocks. Of all these curios and precious trinkets, the district offices, that is the imperial offices, are not compelled to raise their heads and submit them as taxes in order to enrich the middle kingdom, etc. What they're saying is that officials are keeping this stuff, you know, and they're basically extracting it to their own enrichment. Now, you might be like, aha, those are not the Chinese officials. The Chinese officials in the central court are not even getting this. But you have to be a good historian and realize that what the official is saying is that the whole point of having an office in Zhao Qi is to get that material to the capital. That's the whole point, to extract all of those riches and get them to enrich the middle kingdom. And by the middle kingdom, they don't mean Zhao Qi. They mean the capital, right? And the problem here is that the middle officials are taking it and not sending it forward. So this is very clearly, this is a record of the extractive policy of empire. I'm not saying empire is 100% bad. Again, listen to our last episode, right? It's not. It's complicated, as with everything in human history. But if you think that the Sinitic empires never extracted resources, you've got to go back to your history books. And if you think, yeah, go ahead.
It's like, I don't understand how anybody could say that. Like, what is the logic and the proof? Because when we think about, we hear this word, the Chinese army, the greatness of the Chinese army.
Yeah.
What are they doing? Defending themselves? I mean, it just...
Well, exactly.
It doesn't make any sense when you have these armies that are so massive.
Right.
They and you know, in Vietnamese history, they come down and they fight. Mm. And it's like, yeah. Well, how is it possible that there are stories all over the world about the Chinese army, but people are saying that they're not into empire building? It's hard to understand.
And this is why in media, the favorite, you know, the favorite contemporary sort of battle image of pre-modern China is the Chinese against the quote-unquote barbarians, because it's this imperial armies are always depicted as defending the peace of the heartland. I mean, think of Mulan, you know, like crazy people coming over the mountain pass and these valiant imperial troops protecting the heartland. I'm not saying that wasn't true a lot of the time, but that is not the only, you know, identity or role that these imperial armies played. And to this point, you know, the Zheng Sisters Rebellion, which we talked about briefly last time in this episode, you know, is a good example, because other people in the comments were like, oh, the people who adopted Sinitic language, Sinitic culture, Sinitic writing, they did it voluntarily. They volunteered to become a part of this because, you know, they wanted the benefit of it. Well, it's very clear from the Sinitic record, the Ho Han Shu, the book of later Han, where we get our earliest account of the Zheng Sisters Rebellion, that the Zheng Sisters were like, no, thank you. You know, they were like, something is happening that's not good here. The governor is being exploitative in a certain way, and we have had enough, you know? And Ma Yuan comes down and he reconquers. This is the second time, right? Lu Boda did it first. Reconquers the region, executes the Zheng Sisters, and not only executes the Zheng Sisters, but executes their entire leadership, hundreds and hundreds of people. Now, again, I can hear the nationalist response being like, well, these people were rebelling. They were rebelling. Well, if this is a voluntary basis, you should let them go. You can't have it both ways, right? So let me be very clear. You know, this question about this point, this idea that the Sinitic Empire has never conquered anybody is patently, historically, demonstrably untrue. And we are not going to spend more time on it because this is the podcast called The Vietnamese and Viet Origins. There's plenty of stuff online and plenty of stuff in your libraries that will show you that that's not the case. But secondly, why might that be rubbing you the wrong way? It might be rubbing you the wrong way because you are thinking in terms of modern nationalist identity. You're thinking as a Chinese person or a Chinese national today. I'm not talking about the PRC. I really could, but I'm not talking about the PRC, right? And when I talk about the Han conquest, I'm talking about the Han conquest, not the Chinese conquest. Once again, going back to one of our earlier episodes, there are no Chinese or Vietnamese people at this time. The peoples that existed at that time will eventually produce the Chinese and Vietnamese peoples as we know them. So I'm not saying the Han are the modern Chinese people, and I'm not saying that the Nông Sơn or the people who followed Thái Bà Trưng, the Trưng sisters, are Vietnamese peoples. It's very complicated. And one of the things that actually I was sort of alluding to in our last episode is that, at least from the perspective of language, Vietnamese culture comes out of that period of quote-unquote northern domination. Our ancestors really are the people that grew up from the Han through Tang period. The admixture of Sinitic peoples living in this Southeast Asian area, those are our ancestors. That's where we come from. That's why, for example, we had a whole episode talking about essentially the nativeness, like the role or the way in which Han Viet, Sinitic language, Văn Ngôn, literary Chinese, the way in which that language belongs to Vietnamese culture. You know, so maybe that is the next set of questions we can talk about. But I want to make that clear because it's so easy, like it's so easy now to hear, like you might be listening and be like, yeah, you know, that's right. Damn you Chinese. I'm not saying that. I'm saying you're historically inaccurate when you say that the Sinitic Empire has never conquered anybody, but I'm also not playing the team sport of this nation versus that nation.
Right, right.
And yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. But there's also implications to this argument as well, because there's a lot of Americans that think that America has not invaded anywhere. I swear, there's people that really believe that we are a democratic, loving country, and we stay out of everybody's affairs. We're just there to support. We're just there to help.
Exactly. It's very similar. Yeah.
Very similar. But how does a country get rich and powerful? The only way you can do it is you extract basically free labor, free resource from other countries. And you do it in ways that are very clever as a country who is a superpower. You do it in ways that you rebrand and you rename exploitative projects. Exactly. And you know, you're going after oil, you're going after labor, you're going after resources that exist in other countries. You cannot become a superpower. I mean, let me be clear. You cannot become a superpower if you're not extracting from other poor countries. That's just the bottom.
Exactly.
And
I like this topic. Let me say one more thing about this topic because it's good. Yeah. The comparison with America is good because I think we all have this collective amnesia about how America was occupied. Is that the word? I mean, this was not, I start my Vietnam Civ class with this idea that this was not an empty land. You know, the United States was not empty of people when we still call them colonists, when the colonists arrived, right? And there was a series of negotiation, treaty, alliance, and of course, murder and genocide that lies at the foundation of the United States, you know? At the same time, you know, the Qing and the Han came down, it's not like the area in Asia south of the Yellow River and especially south of the Yangtze River was empty. It absolutely was not. It was filled with people and filled with cultures and filled with kingdoms and states. And, you know, and so all of those peoples were conquered. They were conquered. It's not like they had a sign-up sheet. Do you want to join the empire? You know, that is just not true, you know? That's a good comparison. At the same time, of course, there's this other thing about stability in the state. I can hear the counter argument. Well, you know, we're bringing stability. And I actually don't want to minimize that point because, yes, I'm not trained enough or smart enough as a political theorist to understand how to bring peace to the world, you know? And I don't know, I'm not confident, you know, how humans are going to be able to accomplish that, you know, without violence. I hope that's the hope, you know? But certainly that's not the way we've done it in the past. And there have been good things that have resulted after bloody affairs, you know? And I just don't understand enough how to pass judgment. But you're kidding yourself if you think that you got there without any blood, you know? So I just want to say that. I had another thought, but it's out of my mind. So maybe we can move on.
Well, we're probably going to put more blood on your hands when we say An Viet, Chinese or Vietnamese.
Mm. And this is more germane to our actual discussion, right? This is what the actual episode was about. And it's good to talk about this now after having talked about all of that, because you might think once again that I'm building up an argument to be like, oh, the Vietnamese were conquered, enslaved, and oppressed by the Chinese, and then we won our independence. That is our nationalist story, you know? And I'm not saying that, because what I'm really saying once again is that what becomes Vietnamese culture in the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries, by the time we get to the Li Chen dynasties, is a direct descendant, not of Đông Sơn, but of this 1,000 years of development in every level. We are the descendants, at least the partial descendants of the Han through Tang dynasties. And a good way to think about that is language. And one of the things I tried to get across in that episode, but maybe I didn't emphasize it enough, is that we should think of Han Viet. I mean, we're using the term Han Viet now, but what I really mean is Văn Ngôn, you know, literary Chinese. We should think of Văn Ngôn as a native literary language of Vietnamese culture. It is Vietnamese. And for so long, it was the Vietnamese literary language. You know, so going back to, we talked about Nam Quoc Xuân Hà, I think is the poem that we talked about. Mm-hmm. But there's so many other poems we could have talked about. We could talk about Nguyễn Trãi's poetry. Side note, I'm doing that thing, I'm interrupting myself. But side note, people love Nguyễn Trãi's Nôm poetry, and it is interesting. But Nguyễn Trãi's Sinitic poetry, his Văn Ngôn poetry, is absolutely beautiful. It's just stunning. Look up a poem called Ting Wu, Listening to the Rain. It's so beautiful. So these poems are written in Wan Ngôn, you know, and I think somebody in the comments got really upset that I was like, this is a Sinitic language. This is not Vietnamese. What I meant by that is that this is not the Vietnamese language. It's not the genealogical language that we call Vietnamese today. It is Sinitic. It's literary Chinese. But it absolutely is Vietnamese, because the thing I was trying to say was the author of that poem, like Nguyễn Trãi later in the 15th century, when he wanted to express his heart, the most natural language he selected to do so was literary Chinese, was Wan Ngôn. So from that perspective, we should think of literary Chinese as literary Vietnamese, as part and parcel of Vietnamese culture.
I have a question for you. I had a guest on a few weeks ago. It's Han Nguyen from, she's an editor at Salon.com. And I asked her, what makes culture beautiful? And you just said, Ting Wu is a poem by Nguyễn Trãi that is beautiful. What do you mean by that? Like, what makes this beautiful? What, like, why would you describe this poem as a beautiful thing? Is it point of view that comes from the Vietnamese? Like, why do you describe it that way?
That's a huge question. I think we should do another episode on poetry. Okay. And we can read through them and talk about them. But very briefly, I think what makes a cultural artifact beautiful can be many different things. There's such a diversity of things that produce a sense of beauty in culture. You know, I think maybe in a very basic way, if you are a participant of a particular culture and you have shared cultural experiences, you know, for example, we as Vietnamese have a lot of shared 20th century experiences of violence, of, you know, of diaspora, of being, what's the word I'm looking for?
Removed.
Being moved and having lost. There's a word that means to have things taken from you. I can't think of the word.
Displaced.
No. Displaced. Yes. Dislocated. These types of feelings. So if you have a matrix of shared cultural experience like that, and then you come across something that sort of pings that sort of like touches it. It touches the chord of that emotion in you. I think that the response, whether you're crying or laughing, is that that's beautiful because there's a truth to it. Like it feels true. So I think, you know, there is a deep link between a sensibility of truth or authenticity, a sensibility of understanding a thing, and our feeling of it as being beautiful. You know, and when something feels less truthful, we don't connect with it. That's not to say that there are other definitions of beauty that are absolutely untruthful. For example, there are beautiful stories that just make so much sense to us as humans, but they're totally lies, you know?
But it still pings you. And I think that's sort of the idea of beauty, is that there's a point of view in it, embedded in it, that pings you, that awakens me. And I think whether they're a lie or they're not real or they are real, I think the ability to... I always say this to young directors or young painters or young writers, because some people will ask me, like, what makes something good? What makes something great?
Yeah.
Can you move somebody? Can you ping somebody? And I think you answered it with the Nguyễn Trãi poem. And I would love to do an episode on this poetry reading, because what makes somebody a few hundred years later get pinged, right? There's like this beacon somewhere that happened hundreds of years ago. So it's beautiful. I'm glad that
you... Yeah. Let's talk about that poem one day, because it is. It's a gorgeous poem. Yeah, really is.
So you have doublets, triplets, etc. These are
options
that,
We've got a bunch of... Maybe we can do a little bit of a rapid fire as we close out, because we've got a bunch of interesting observations and questions on various different topics that are sort of adjacent to the main topic of Wan Ngôn, which was the topic of last episode. So the first one, someone asked a question about how does using Chữ Nôm or Chữ Hán versus Quốc Ngữ, an alphabet, interact with this phenomenon of doublets or triplets? And by that, this commentator meant words that could be written by the same character, but maybe represent slightly different pronounced words, or maybe even the same pronounced words. He gave a lot of great examples. I'll give you just one very simple example, like the character, which means south, you know, if you can be used to write the word Nam, which means south, because that is a Sinitic word. That's a Chinese word meaning south, right? So you can use that, you can write that character in either Han or Nom, and it can mean south and it can be pronounced Nam, but can also be used to write the word Nam, which is five, right? And sometimes you see the Nom version of that character with a little five on the left-hand side to tell you that that is, but it's very often written just with the character for south. So that's one small example. So, on the one hand, there's a type of practice in Nom. This is secretly a Nom topic, so, but I'll allow it because maybe you'll listen to our Nom episode, which is coming out next. But this is a bit of a Nom issue because in Du Nom, you will often use one character to write a range of different words in Vietnamese. And that also happens in Du Han. It happens in Chinese as well. And it's true that if those words are pronounced slightly differently, like Nam versus Nam, then having an alphabet like Quốc ngữ does allow you to distinguish, right? Because you're writing Nam with the A versus Nam with just this normal A. And then you know one is Nam and one is Nam. But the opposite is actually much more common in Vietnamese and especially in Chinese because there are many homonyms in Vietnamese. There are many words that have the same pronunciation in Vietnamese, right? And in those words, in Du Nom, at least in late era Du Nom, where you start to add more what we call radicals to distinguish the meaning, then you can see the difference in the meaning in the form of the character. And you don't have that in Quốc ngữ. It's not as much of an issue in Vietnamese as it is in Chinese because there are way more homonyms in Chinese. And the type of character that has an element that gives you a hint for what it means are much higher in Chinese than in Du Nom. But still, people have this feeling sometimes. And people do it a lot in Han Viet. You know, to go back to our question of like, is Văn Ngôn Vietnamese? You know, is literary Chinese Vietnamese? And we said yes. When we say Han Viet and we mean the Chinese vocabulary in the Vietnamese language, I would also say yes, that's an element of the Vietnamese language, right? Those are Vietnamese words. They are also Chinese words, but they are Vietnamese words. Now back to this topic, I hear this ambiguity a lot when people use a Han Viet. They're like, oh, especially in naming, if you don't know characters, if you don't know the original character, they'll be like, oh, you know, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a good example, but they'll choose a word and they'll be like, it can mean this, but it can also mean that, you know? And it's okay because now you just have the Quốc ngữ, but if you had the characters, you'd see that, oh, the characters are not the same. So those are actually two different words. And now with Quốc ngữ, you're kind of blind to that etymology because you no longer have the characters in your mind. So you lose something both ways. You know, we had a bunch of questions about what is more, well, many of them were not questions. Many of them were vociferous opinions about what is more efficient, what is more, you know, what is more advanced, you know, Sinitic writing or Nom or the alphabet. There's a lot of writing about this, and we could do another episode about this. I'll just say very quickly, the neurolinguistic evidence shows us that there's actually quite little difference between the way in which a human reads the alphabet versus the way in which a human reads Chinese or Sinitic writing. There are some interesting neurolinguistic differences. There are. But at the end of the day, it's not very different, especially in our information age. But you do lose information either way. You know, with characters, you cannot be precise with regard to how to pronounce those words. So you lose that information that you gain that with Quốc ngữ. But with Quốc ngữ, you lose, because of the number of homonyms, you lose the ability to distinguish between homonyms because you don't see the characters with that sort of the semantic element in them. So that's a short answer to that very interesting and good comment about doublets and triplets. Yeah. So I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, we can. We have some time left, and we can. I think the two things on the list that I wanted to really address is the Cai Lương and the Âu Lạc An Dương Vương.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So your pick.
Yeah.
One commentator mentioned, they were like, oh, you know, like the Han Viet that, you know, Nam Quoc Son Ha is Han Viet or Ban Ngôn, it's all Sinitic words, right? And this commentator was like, oh, I don't know if you knew, but like in Cai Lương, by the way, my dad is a huge Cai Lương fan. And also shout out to Leon Lay, my buddy, my friend, a very talented director. His new movie is coming out, Gay Nam. It's at the Toronto Film Festival. But his first feature film is called... Sông Lan. Thank you. I forgot for a second.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of that movie.
It's so good. It's all about... Cai Lương. Yeah.
It's about beauty.
Exactly. He's got a great aesthetic sense, Leon.
He really does, And I watched Gay Nam too. It's
did you?
Yeah.
I haven't watched it yet. I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah. Such a beautiful film too.
I can't wait.
I'm a fan of everything he does, everything Tony Bui does, everything Bao Wei does. You know, those three are my, you know, I'll put it out there. Those three are my favorite directors.
We have some talented directors.
We really do. Yeah. We really do.
In this community.
Ham Tran and Lydia Sinesh. These guys, you know, those are the five directors. You know, that I always talk about. But yeah, going back, I'm sorry.
Sam Lang is about the sunset period of Cai Lương in Saigon, in Ho Chi Minh City in the 80s. And it's just beautiful. But if you are a fan of Cai Lương, and everyone should be, because Cai Lương is really amazing, it is first notably in the vernacular. It is in the Vietnamese language, as opposed to Tuong, you know, something like Tuong. Although there is Vietnamese language Tuong now as well. But Cai Lương is primarily intelligible Vietnamese language. But of course, as this person pointed out, if you listen to the lyrics of Cai Lương or you read them, you see interwoven throughout all of Cai Lương, you know, a lot of Han Viet words, phrases, especially if you're looking at a Cai Lương based on a classical story, you know, like story Mi E, that kind of story. Because when you're telling a story about a classical topic, then that is exactly the space that Han Viet provides us a lot of language, you know, to express high philosophical ideas like sacrifice, devotion, things like that. So we are going, it is part of our Vietnamese language to reach out to Han Viet and to use that, interweave it into something like Cai Lương. Same with Chuyện Kiều. You read Chuyện Kiều, there is so much Han Viet in Chuyện Kiều for exactly the same reason, you know?
No,
but then you look... Sorry.
I wanted to jump in real quick. Wait. Can you finish your thought and then I'll jump in?
I was just going to say, then Cai Lương is very, very diverse. So then if you're watching a Cai Lương that's about, you know, some little boy in the Mekong, you know, and how he goes on the river every day, like that Cai Lương will probably not have very much Han Viet in it. And that is just an example of the flexibility of the Vietnamese language.
This is exactly what I wanted to address. Exactly. When I think about Cai Lương as a kid, I think about blues music. I don't know why. It's weird. The correlation that I make, and I know as I learn more about it, I'm way off. And here's what I mean by that. When I think about Cai Lương, I don't, and I'm so sorry to all the people that I grew up with listening to Cai Lương. Not that I think you're not sophisticated, because I'm sure it's a very sophisticated thing, but I just always remember that it was never my father's thing, and it was never like in the world that he occupied, and the class structure that he occupied. A lot of these guys were not fans of Cai Lương, but it was the fishermen that worked in our factories that were the blue collar guys that were in my mom and dad's factory that were always jamming to Cai Lương. And it always made me think about like the deep bayou in Mississippi. But I didn't understand it at the time. I didn't really listen to it. And now I'm understanding from you that it's Han Viet. But now that, you know, after obviously Leon Lay's Sông Lan and beginning to understand a little bit more about the quality of the language that's showing up in these Cai Lương, I think about Italian opera, right? Mm-hmm. I think about language that, you know, we in America, we go to the theater, we go to opera, and we listen to Italian opera, we listen to German opera, Wagner, we listen to French opera, but we don't, there's not American opera. And so the sophistication of Cai Lương to me is weirdly kind of a combination of blue collar, but yet opera going people who understand it from this Italian, French, you know, classy kind of, you know, you get dressed up to go to opera. So it Gailun is a lot more complex than we actually think it is, or actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, there are American operas. I mean, I have the same response. So Porgy and Bess is a very famous American opera about the Black South, and it's amazing opera, but it is I'm an opera lover. And it is for me always like vaguely disappointing to go to an opera that's in English. Cause I do want like this part of my experience is to be experiencing it in this language that is slightly removed from my own language, but that is a very modern response to opera because even Italian and French opera originated as a vernacular art form. It was an art form that was kind of popular, you know, and, you know, often kind of very racy. And it did develop into a very high kind of like class oriented art form, but it didn't begin that way. And Gailun is very similar. What does Gailun mean anyway? Gailun means reform. It's a reform of opera. Gai, you know, so it's reformed opera. It's a reform of Dung and Cheo, those types of more older forms of opera, to be more vernacular, to sort of be more in touch with the Vietnamese vernacular sound and space, you know? I mean, Cheo was also vernacular, but Gailun meant to be a fusion of high operatic forms like Dung, but married to vernacular language and speech. And that's sort of where it comes from. And it has a complex history because it actually was quite sophisticated in its, you know, in its early history and its middle history. But then it does kind of, it does diversify to even encompass, I don't know if you've seen these, but to even encompass almost like soap opera-y kind of storylines and things like that. And people really relish in the part of Gailun that is sourced in folk meter and folk song in Vietnam. And it becomes popular there. And then in South Vietnam, you know, in that era, there's still a huge component of Gailun enthusiasts. But we're also talking about a time when, I feel like I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but we're in a time when American and French cultural forms are super popular and super, you know, prevalent, you know, in the 60s, you know, rock music, you know, innovative rock music comes to South Vietnam. You have this incredible rock scene in South Vietnam. So there is a kind of distribution, I think, of fandom over those decades, and Gailun moves into a particular space, you know? So I think that is true. But when you think about Gailun, you want to think about it as, I think it's heydays earlier, you know, and then it has a bit of a revival that Leon knows about. And then because by that point, it was kind of the blue collar, you know, that really enjoyed it and loved it and was really keeping it alive, you know, in this very special way. And then eventually, of course, it sort of just fades away. But
we could do a complicated entire episode on Gailun and opera because I opera is...
You should get Leon. You should get Leon. He's Leon, like Leon. Such a... He's a fan guam of Gailun.
Yeah, I think I didn't know you were an opera fan. I am. I love opera as well.
Oh.
I'm probably not as big of a fan as you are, but if we dissect the music, the pleasant notes on the ear, God, I hate to drift into these grand generalities, but I have to. Just this is just personal preference and just telling you how I feel about. I'm not a big fan of the dissonant qualities of the music that comes out of Gailun or blues, because you're using a lot of I think in blues is pentatonic scales, right? Which are like five note scales, and I feel like Gailun is sort of in that mode where the notes are very bendy. And they're very sort of when you think about like classical opera, it's based on very traditional, non-dissonant, non-jazzy. Not to say that I don't like jazz, but the how easy it is to kind of listen to an opera piece without all the dissonant chords and all of the, you know, the bendy notes. makes Kailun very different from Paris by Night pre-75 Nhạc Vàng, right? It's just the different quality of the way the notes are shaping up in your ears. And I think we could do a whole episode on that because, you know,
that's interesting. About
very much.
That's really interesting. I do think, just very quickly, because I do want to get to some of these last questions, but I love this topic so much. You know, I do think there are moments in Cai Lương where you achieve a similar purity, like the sort of climax of an aria in Western opera. You know, in both Western opera and in Cai Lương, as well as notably Duong, you will sometimes reach like a high note or a high space that is also the emotional apex, you know, of the whatever that scene is. And that is a similarity. But of course, the scale is, you're right, that it is the pentatonic scale, you know. And that is a very interesting history, how in Western Europe, you know, they developed harmonics in the seven-note scale. It's totally yes. interesting history. And it does do different things emotionally, you know, like there's a whole, I mean, I think there's a deep mystery there. It's really interesting. One thing I will agree with you on that I don't even like in Western opera is recitative. Recitative is like the boring part in between the arias where they're like talk singing. I hate that. I don't hate that. I take that back. Sometimes it's really gorgeous. But there is a lot of that, you know, in Cai Lương as well, you know? So it would be an interesting conversation to talk about those different forms of opera. Mm-hmm. I'd love to do that one.
Because there's so many parallels in culture that goes back hundreds of years ago, and nobody was like interneting, nobody was, you know, talking across the ocean about these different modalities, these different scales that were being used in Europe or the US or Vietnam. You know, it's just but there's parallels here, and it's weird how it all works. So one day we can get into it.
Yes. And if you want to hear that, let us know. we'll look for that. All right. So I do want to get to a couple. So you wanted to talk about Olac, which I do want to talk about. But if it's okay, can I talk quickly about Index Scripts and Juhuano, which are two interesting little topics that people brought up. So one person, because we started that last episode with the origins of writing in humankind, you know, the four accepted origins of writing. And then someone was like, what about all the Indic scripts, especially the Brahmi script, which is, you know, the oldest Indic script? Let me first say that those four origins are just the scholarly accepted origins. There could be more, certainly, very possibly there are more, but it has not been proven or demonstrated to a sort of clear degree yet. It is a little mo-hole when you go to India. So the Brahmi scripts, as far as I understand, it's not my expertise, but the Brahmi scripts, as far as I understand it, have been thought to be derived from Semitic scripts. Remember the Semitic scripts, like the Phoenician alphabet, in turn is thought to derive from Egyptian hieroglyphics.
Semitic. So, it's like Semites, coming from the Semites. Semitic.
Oh, Semitic, exactly. So ancient Hebrews, ancient Arabs, those peoples, right? So that is the, as far as I understand it, the accepted sort of theory with regard to where the Indic scripts come from, and probably through a space like, the Indus River Valley is the point of contact. Although the Indus River Valley culture has its own undeciphered writing, what seems to be like writing. So it's very unclear. And I think that is one place where I think scholars are still a little unsure, you know. That's the first thing. And then another comment someone made was about what's called Juhuano. Juhuano means a couple different things. Huado is tadpole, kutou in Chinese. So tadpole script means two different things in the Vietnamese context. The first thing it means is what it means in Sinitic or Chinese context, which is an ancient form of script that existed before the standardization of script in China. So there are many records and examples, actually, of this incredible diversity of scripts in China. It's not like they're not Chinese scripts, but it's that ancient Chinese script that was one of the four inventions of writing diversified into all these different forms of scripts. And a subset of those different forms in the first millennium BC are what we now call tadpole scripts. And they're characterized by like a one end of the stroke is heavy and the other end is light. So that's why it looks like a tadpole. And that is the most classic meaning of tadpole script. And those are eradicated because when you get to the Qing dynasty, people are like, this is untenable. Everyone writes things differently. So we got to get rid of all these other forms and we got to just write one way. Okay. So that's one definition of tadpole script. But then in the 19th century, I think it's 19th or early 20th century. And I tried to find this before I came on, but I couldn't find his name. There is a Vietnamese anthropologist who wrote a book. He was kind of trained in the French school and he went around like Hua Bing, that sort of north central area. And he documented all these different ethnic groups and also their different forms of writing. And he documents a bunch of different scripts and he calls them Jing Hua Lo. I think that might be what this commentator is referring to, these scripts. And those scripts are actually Indic scripts. They're scripts that are, if I remember correctly, I have worked on this text, but way back in graduate school, so I couldn't find it today. But if I remember correctly, that's an important caveat. These scripts are mostly Tai peoples who are Kradai ethnic and ethno-linguistic peoples. And different Tai groups have different forms of writing their language. So some of them use a Sinitic style script, and we call it Chu Nom Tai, because it looks like Chu Nom, but it's to represent Tai language. But the other groups use a script that is related to the actual Lao or Thai script or Cambodian script, which are all related, I think, to an Indic script called Pallava. But those are ultimately of Indic origin. And those scripts are not Sinitic, they're alphabetical. You know, they're an alphabetic script. And if I remember correctly, the way he uses Du Hua Dao is to refer to those non-Sinitic forms of writing that he was encountering in North Central Vietnam in the highlands.
I just looked up this Vietnamese anthropologist. Is it Nguyen Van Cang?
I honestly don't remember, but I know it's like late 19th, early 20th century kind of French school anthropologist who went around the North, and he wrote a book, which I have a PDF of. I just couldn't find it. But maybe that is him. Yeah, could be. Okay. But I wanted to answer those two very specific questions because I thought they were great questions. Yeah. So, OLAC. So let me, we had a bunch of very lively discussions about the early conquest history of the South, you know, going back to the earlier part of this AMA. And then many people were citing, okay, there was Van Lang, you know, there was Van Lang, and then there was Olak, and then there was this guy, An Dung Vuong, you know, and then Chiu Da came in, and, you know, I've seen the Cai Lương, I've seen the Chiao, you know, I know that story, and he was conquered, etc. And there's a rich, rich, rich canon of stories about this early part of Vietnamese history, that focuses on the early conquests of the region before the Han Dynasty conquest. Because the Han conquer the area of northern Vietnam when it is already part of a kingdom that we've talked about briefly called Nam Viet or Nam Nghĩa. That's Chiu Da's kingdom. But before that, there was indeed evidence of another kingdom that we now call Olac. And before Olac, there probably was another kingdom that shout out to Professor Nam Kim's episode. I'm sure he talked about it. That was centered on the site that we now call Go Lua. So first thing I'll say is that, and we've talked about this, Ken, I think we should do a whole episode on that early history because it's complicated. And most of the stories from which we extract that story, that the traditional story, they are written much, much later. You know, like the traditional history you might have learned is we had the Hùng kings ruling over Van Lang, and then there's a whole bunch of them, and then An Dung Vuong comes in from the outside and conquers that kingdom, and there is a mixed kingdom that he creates called Olac, right? And then the site of it is Go Lua. We have a whole bunch of stories about that. There's a chicken, there's a turtle, there's a ghost story, there's a bunch of stories there, and then Olac is conquered by Chiu Da. And there's another bunch of stories there, right? Golden magic crossbow, etc. And then ultimately to, you know, Namvir is conquered by the Han. But those stories are all written in, almost all of them are written in the second millennium, most of them as late as the 15th century. So they are very inconsonant with the history of what a lot of people in the comments called the Ba Yue, or the, you know, like Viet, the Hundred Yue peoples, all these different peoples in the south. So let's do an episode about that. But all I want to say now is that, again, hearkening back to the early part of this conversation, the land was not empty before Sinitic peoples came in. And the Domsun peoples, probably plural, were all over the place in the Red River Plain. And indeed, again, shout out to Nam Kim, they built what was the largest, most sophisticated urban site in all of Southeast Asia at that time, which is Golwa, which is what we call Golwa. So there was strong evidence of a sophisticated polity there. But let's wait for another episode to really discuss.
You know, a real fun episode would be to have you and Nam see Kim on together.
I would love that.
Yeah.
I would love that.
You guys have met before, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We've met several times. We've collaborated several times. He's a professor in my hometown, Madison, Wisconsin. Right. Right. Shout out Madison. So that is a great idea.
Yeah. I'll bring him on and we'll talk about this idea of Golwa because Nam and I talk as much as you and I talk. We talk quite often in the... He would love to talk about this. So,
yeah,
so we'll do this. Yeah, we'll do this together. John, this was amazing. Should we tease out the next episode? Because we've already recorded and I would love to let everybody know.
Yes, absolutely. So our next content episode is about Ju Nom and how it developed. So last content episode was about literary Chinese as a form of native writing to Vietnamese people. And now we're finally going to get to the topic of how the Vietnamese language itself came to be written down initially in the form of Ju Nom. So listen, it's a great episode and post your questions there and we'll get to an AMA on that episode after that. So please tune in.
Thank you so much, John.
Thanks, Kenneth. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.